Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. It's great to be back with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. Good to see you again, Chief.
Great to see you. We've got lots of interesting things to talk about today.
Well, the first thing I'd like to talk to you about is the ice storm. Now, our area experienced a serious ice storm earlier this month. There was a lot of damage, school closings, and many people went without power for an extended period of time. Can you describe how Alderville was hit during the ice storm?
Yes. So I can briefly say that Alderville was severely hit by the ice storm. We knew it was going to be bad on the Saturday night when the ice was still accumulating on the trees, and around early wee hours of the morning, we could hear the trees crashing down and branches coming down. So we knew that there was going to be some severe damage, and we didn't quite know the effect of it, but the power had been out since the previous night across the community. So what we did was we opened up the community center for people to drop in who needed some warmth because it was still very cold outside. We served beverages, coffee, tea, as well as three meals a day. So our staff just jumped to action. Volunteers came in, and it's almost without prodding, everything came together, and we were hosting the entire community or whoever wanted to come at the community center.
Do you know how many people you served during that period of time?
It's hard to put a figure to it, but I can say that the community center was full pretty much for the number of days that we had it on the go. We had cots out, so anyone that needed to spend the night would spend the night. We had the children playing around, so we had elders and we had children playing around. It was a very lively time. So in a lot of ways, the sense of community was really there, despite the fact that it was under very extreme circumstances that we were brought together.
Now, how is it that you were so well prepared? I mean, to be feeding that many people three times a day.
Well, I think we'd have to wind the clock back over 5 years ago when I first noticed that the COVID crisis was going to start spreading. I was on council at the time, so I raised the alarm bells and I said we should be preparing the community to in fact, host probably a number of citizens in the community center if necessary. So that started the ball rolling on getting the community center prepared. We got some COVID funding from the federal government, like all communities did. So what we did was we went ahead and we renovated the kitchen. So we updated it from a regular kitchen to an industrial kitchen. We bought new freezers. So we really increased our capacity for some sort of a crisis. Plus, being already having a crisis not that long ago when it did happen, we were prepared. We had a lot of food in the freezers. So we actually used up all the food right away. So then we started accepting donations. So a number of community leaders, business partners stepped up and they provided meals for us throughout the duration of the emergency.
How long did it last for you guys?
Well, my power was out for 5 days, and that was probably average. We know that the last person that I know of that got their power back was just this past Monday. So we're looking at, you know, coming on a week and a half, maybe even 2 weeks for some people, how long their power was out. So we really just want to give a big shout out to the Hydro One Network employees who were working around the clock to restore our power. We're very thankful for them.
And how many days did you offer the community center as an emergency shelter?
I believe it was 3 or 4 days. We kept it going for as long as people were dropping in. But as power got restored, we were we made the decision to shut it down when no one else was coming. The good news is that we had a number of generators on site that we were able to hook up to people that needed power, as well as a couple companies. They donated a number of generators to us, so we had enough generators to power everyone who needed it. So that took care of the emergency. In fact, we had so many generators that we were able to send a dozen to Curve Lake, who were experiencing even more severe crisis than us. So we were able to help them out in this time.
How extensive was the damage?
I think a lot of the damage was from the falling trees and branches on homes. So some eaves, troughs, and gutters might have been damaged, dents in tin roofs, a lot of power lines down, obviously. But I think the most severe damage, because the structural damage wasn't as much as it could have been, was the sump pumps. When they lost power, they turned off. And because there was so much water coming down, it was the spring melt, a number of basements were flooded. And that's going to be the long-term remediation that we have to deal with. So we're talking about, stripping drywall up to like 6, 8, 1 feet just to redo everything. So it's going to be a long process because, of course, with a flooded basement comes the health issues of mold. And if it's not safe to be in your home, then we have to find alternate arrangements for those residents.
What was it like? What did people do in the community center while they were waiting?
Yes. So we actually had the big drum set up. So anytime, things started getting into a lull, the drummers would get on the drum and sing a song, and that really invigorated our spirits. We brought out all the toys for the children. I'm not sure if you know what a plasma car is, but it's one of those cars you sit on and you turn the wheel and it propels yourself. So you had little kids that were just zipping around the community center, around the elders. We had food on the go. So I think we had people had decks of cards, so a lot of euchre and other card games were going on. So I think overall, people were happy, they were hydrated, they were having their coffee, and people were just chatting. There's a lot of people that, may not normally come together in this fashion were together. So you saw people they haven't seen for a while. So it was really, it was like one large community event that lasted for days.
Are there any lessons learned this time to improve for the next time?
I think we probably could have gotten a bit more of a head start knowing that this was coming. I lived through the ice storm of 1998 in Ottawa and Quebec, and that I should have learned the lesson from them. We should have maybe been a bit more ready, just preparing, make sure there's enough food in the freezers. But the fact that we just responded so quickly, I can't say enough about our staff and our volunteers who stepped up. It almost seemed seamless. I know it wasn't. So there's always areas to improve. We had a debrief at the end of everything where we sat together and we're like, okay, what went right and what went wrong? And I think one of the big things that came out of it was, we should have a volunteer reserve that could jump into action. So maybe when we knew something's going to happen, we could put them on alert and say, hey, volunteers, this is your time. You're probably going to jump into action here. Because even though we managed to meet all the needs, we had certain employees that were definitely working harder than should have been expected of anybody reasonably. So those are the ones that I'm really thankful for, because they just kept doing it. They were keeping the generators filled with gas. They were just going around making sure elders were okay. So I think if we could spread that around more to other community members and staff and volunteers, I think that's the big takeaway.
I'd like to talk to you now about some things going on with the Chiefs of Ontario. I understand that the Chiefs of Ontario are looking for input for consultants to review services and political structures. Now, this sounds like it's pretty boring and sort of the inside the ballpark stuff. But if you look at the fine print, there's more to this. Can you share what's going on with this review?
Well, I think this is a good exercise for the Chiefs of Ontario, just because they want to make sure that they're hitting the mark for what the organization's intended to do. It is a Chiefs organization, but at the end of the day, the Chiefs are responsible for the community members. So I think they're just trying to ensure that the services and the mandates that they're advocating for fit in line with the today's needs for the First Nation citizens across this province.
Can you explain the organizational structure within the Indigenous community, the differences between, say, the Chiefs of Ontario and the AFN and the Anishinaabe Nation and your relationship with all of those?
Okay, let's see. There's two ways to start this. I could start from the top down or the bottom up. So I'm going to start with the bottom. So if you have the unit of First Nation governance being Alderville First Nation, you know, we are a sovereign nation. We can operate on our own. That's great. We could, but you know, there's only so many things you can get done on your own. So you go off and you are part of other First Nation groups. So Alderville's belongs to the Oglewash Tribal Council, which is based out of Rama, and there's six First Nations in there. We're also part of the Mississauga Nation, which is a group of the Mississauga in Ontario, and that's six Mississauga First Nations. But our tribal council, that's a political tribal organization, is it's called Anishinaabeg Nation, and there are 39 First Nations, and this is where the base level of advocacy for Anishinaabe First Nations in Ontario operate from. And Anishinaabeg Nation is one of three major political bodies that make up the Chiefs of Ontario. So the others are the AIAI, which is the Haudenosaunee group, and some of their allies. And then you also have Anishinaabe Aski, which is a lot of the northern Ontario First Nations. And then there's other independent ones, some treaty groups that join in, and they all make up the Chiefs of Ontario, which is Ontario's largest governing body. And we have an Ontario regional chief who runs from there. And every province has its own regional chief, and they make up the executive council of the Assembly of First Nations, which is the largest Indigenous group in the country. So the AFN is the highest political body. But when you get that big, you start running into problems of who do you represent and how do you represent everyone adequately.
How do members of your community communicate through all of these channels to get things done?
Well, a lot of our First Nations, if they've got a good idea or a program that they're advocating for, what we can do is when we go to these larger groups like the AFN, we can give up some of our floor time to one of those members to present what they are doing. I did that last year in Ottawa. There was a member who just had a really important initiative for plastics. So an international treaty on the regulation of plastics, how they're getting in the water. And it's an environmental hazard. So I thought that was a really good area to promote on the biggest stage for First Nations in Canada. So you'll get a lot of things like that. So it's sort of up to the chiefs to put these items on the agenda.
How do you feel about all of these organizations and the time and energy that has to be put into all of them to get things done?
Well, that's a very good question. So time management is key for chiefs. I'm away out of the community pretty much every other week at one of these big organizations, conferences that are happening all the time. But I feel they're very important. Alderville's sitting at tables that we've never sat up before. Our voice is being heard. You know, we're making partnerships with proponents. And I think that's important, but at the same time, you've got to balance that with being in the community. Because if you're away every other week or even every week, as it seems like it's been lately, then you're not as much in the community working on those grassroots levels. So you need to find that balance of being in the community and representing the community out there to the larger world.
Do you think any changes need to take place?
Well, there's always room for improvement. That's for sure. I think, I might have mentioned it before on one of our podcasts that the decorum sometimes in these large chiefs meetings isn't the best. You get arguing and things like that. And I know that happens in any political body on the House of Commons floor, Queen's Park, that happens. So I would just like to see, you know, everyone just, you know, make their case. Some people want to talk for forever. Just try to get what you have to say done quickly so that, you know, instead of a 3-day conference, you could make it a 2-day conference and then, you know, people, chiefs get their whole day back. So I think making things a bit more abbreviated would be ideal.
What do you hear from your fellow members on band council about you being away so much?
I think our council members understand the importance of it. They're very supportive. We have a really good band council who understands what they're doing. Oftentimes, if I can't make one of these meetings, I'll send the council member who owns that portfolio to the conference. So our council members are often off at these meetings as well, too. So they understand the importance of it and the need for it. So I really appreciate our council for understanding and stepping up when it's required.
What about the community? What are they saying to you about being off at all these meetings all the time?
You know, I'm not sure the community necessarily knows I'm gone that much. I'm not a big social media poster, so it's not, I could be posting every day about where I'm at, but I just don't do that. So I have a newsletter update that I put in, but even that doesn't cover everything. So, you know, I'm not really sure if the community knows everything that I'm doing and being out there. But I hope that they will eventually see the results, because these aren't necessarily immediate result sessions I'm going to. These are long term things that are going to produce our own source revenue in the future, or get us a really good changes to the existing laws that affect our people. So I'm taking the long game to everything at these meetings. And whoever comes next after me, I hope that you know, they're able to see the need to keep that sort of strategy going.
I wanted to talk to you about housing, in particular transitional housing. In 2024, a point in time count of people living rough or homeless found 1/3 of the 40,000 respondents were Indigenous. Now, most Indigenous people live in urban, rural, and northern areas outside of traditional communities. The need for housing, obviously, is huge, according to multiple reports done between 2021 and 2024. From your perspective, how would you characterize the need for affordable and transitional housing across the country?
Yes, that's a very important issue. There never seems to be enough low-income housing, low-income but quality housing for First Nations. In Alderville, we have taken steps to create a transitional home for young families in need. We are working on a tiny home community of 10 homes that we're going to have families in need that could use that. It'd be a stepping stone to perhaps get them into their own home that they own, or maybe into a different rental unit somewhere in the community. But, you know, we have to look after our own here in Alderville. And there's a number of organizations in Canada that are, you know, providing homes for Indigenous people across the country. So we would like to support those and come to those tables whenever possible.
I understand the federal government earmarked nearly $3 billion in funding to Indigenous housing providers. Do you know what the status is of that money?
I do not. This is one of those things where if it's not directed towards Alderville First Nation or one of the political bodies we belong to, we don't really know too much what's going on there. So you'll have these third-party independent organizations that are working almost on their own. I feel like there should be more engagement with the First Nations community, because that you are start getting a mandate creep that might not necessarily be representing First Nations or not even providing services to Indigenous people.
Where does transitional housing fit on the spectrum of all the different housing types? I know sometimes people get a little confused between transitional housing and affordable housing. Can you just describe quickly what that is?
I think there's a few categories of transitional housing. What we're focused on is child advocacy, where you're taking the best interest of the children. So perhaps you have a family that maybe broke apart and you have a single parent raising their children, but they can't afford it. So they've gone from one home where now they need two homes. And to stop those people from, you know, ending up in really dire situations, we would provide child welfare transitional homes for those families. So that's what our focus is on. There's also transitional housing that people know in the broader sense for people that are maybe incarcerated. They've been released, but they're really starting from scratch and they have no place to go. There's transitional housing for that. We're looking down the road to help fully, hopefully have something in place for that. But currently we're looking at families that have children that need this extra housing boost.
Northumberland County is working on a project at 473 Ontario Street in Cobourg. It is supposed to provide 62 new affordable housing units, including rent geared to income. Now, it was announced in 2021, but recently there was an update and it's supposed to start construction in 2026. Is Alderville involved in this project?
We're involved in the sense that we have been given updates. As far as, you know, helping with the mandate and the goal, I am not aware of us being invited to that table. So my concerns are that, you know, First Nations people aren't actually going to be benefiting from this. If you look at like what the websites are saying, they're for Métis and they're not even necessarily for Indigenous people, which is great. But if you have funding for Indigenous housing that's not going to Indigenous people, that's just one of those things where, you know, that money could perhaps better be streamlined for what it was meant for. So we know with Métis people, especially with the MNO, until they get their membership rules straightened out, we really can't support those type of initiatives for that.
MNO being Métis Nation of Ontario?
Correct.
I understand you're off to the United Nations.
Yes, it's been quite an honor to have been invited. I was surprised, but at the same time delighted that I received an invitation.
Tell us about what you've been invited to do.
Well, it's for Earth Day, and it's about the protections, environmental legal protections for bodies of water across the world. So Indigenous leaders from all over the globe have been invited to speak on Earth Day at the United Nations. I know a number of people from Canada are going. Autumn Peltier, who used to be the water commissioner for Anishinaabeg Nation, will be speaking as well. And we have our legal personhood of Rice Lake and the Ganaraska River Initiative. So that, I think, was the reason I was invited. I believe there's only a couple chiefs from Canada going. So I will be speaking to that. But at the same time, I want to talk a bit about Alderville and all the other great green initiatives we got on the go with our solar farm and our Black Oak Savanna, and just how we are a progressive community that, you know, this is something that all First Nations should be doing, all communities across the world really should be focused on preserving the waters and the lands that we rely on to sustain ourselves.
Do you have any public service announcements for us?
I sure do. I guess it's that time of the podcast. So a few announcements. Our members will have noticed that there's been ongoing prescribed burns across Alderville throughout the month. So this is the time of year where we re-nourish and replenish the lands by doing these burns. So it helps to keep invasive species at bay. Plus, it puts those nutrients back into the ground and helps establish our Indigenous plants more. On May 11th, we have a turtle nest protection seminar at the Black Oak Savannah. So there's only 12 spots available. So if you're interested, can you please call Grace to sign up? And you're going to be making some protector guards for turtle nesting grounds. So when you see some turtles putting eggs down, you put these protectors over and then it ensures that they can hatch without being eaten by any predators. On April 28th, we're having a meal prep day from 10 a.m. to noon at Hilltop, where you can prepare some meals for the coming week. So if you're interested in that, please reach out to the Health and Social Services team. Also, we are looking for members who, maybe not even members, anyone in the larger community who might know about where we have some unmarked graves at our cemetery. We're looking to put names to these unmarked graves so that we can create markers and properly honor those ancestors that we have there. We're also looking for volunteers for our community garden. This is something that we tried a few years ago, and it was a big success, but we need volunteers to make it happen. So if you're interested in volunteering for our community garden, please contact Shermara at the Health and Social Services Building. On May 29th, we have our Alderville Williams Treaty Settlement Trust annual general meeting. If you want to learn what the trust has been up to, what programs they've been supporting, please sign up. It's in person and virtual, and that's from 5 to 8 p.m. again on May 29th. And I just want to put out a call out for people that are looking to become alternative caregivers in the community. We're looking for Indigenous caregivers, what previously would have been called foster care. So if you are interested in becoming an alternative caregiver, please contact Nogdewin Banujiag Child and Family Services. It's our Indigenous-led CFS that we have in Alderville, and it's all over the area, actually. And let's see, we are always looking for donations to the Alderville Food Bank. So if you've got a lot of canned goods or maybe an overstocking of fresh goods, we're always looking for to help you out with those that extra food so that we can disperse it to the community. So that's my announcements. I hope that we see you next time.
Chief Tanner Simpson, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today.
It's been a pleasure, as always.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Tanner Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation, and I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on, the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tanner Simpson.